Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 195, entitled, How to Optimize Your Health, Longevity, and Performance Using Epigenetic Technology and Isochronic Tones, I chat with David Krantz. David Krantz is a health coach, epigenetic coach, and music producer who specializes in creating isochronic tones. In today's episode, David talks about the health benefits of anechoic chambers and isochronic tones and shares his vast understanding of nutrigenomics and why we all respond to certain foods, nutrients, and substances differently. He covers a multitude of health boons that anechoic chambers offer and how isochronic tones actually work to change the brain's function. David holds nothing back in this powerful, jam-packed health episode while sharing how we can all optimize our genes and the way we express them in ways I, up until this point, had no idea was being done. If you're wondering how you can optimize your health, longevity, and performance using epigenetics, fascinating soundless chambers, and incredible audio tones, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, last Tuesday we went down on iTunes for a couple of days. To make a long story short, we didn't submit our podcast correctly way back when, and iTunes took us down for about 72 hours while they sorted through our show. Anyways, we've taken care of the minor issue and we're back up for good. So it's water under the bridge, everything's good, technical little glitch issue, and not a big deal. But if you missed last week's episode, the good news is you have two to listen to today. And yeah, last week's episode was pretty damn epic, so you want to listen to that right after this one. As I mentioned also in last week's episode, you can always find our show on any of the major podcasting platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and all the other big ones too. And of course, you can always find us on elitemanmagazine.com on the homepage. We post there first above anywhere else, and we are always up on the elitemanmagazine.com homepage. So every Tuesday morning, if for some reason in the future you don't find us on your favorite podcasting app, just go to elitemanmagazine.com right on the homepage. I promise you, you will find us there. But this is also a reminder to sign up for the Elite Man newsletter too. This way, you'll always get notified via email when we release a new episode, and you get all of the bonus content not seen nor heard anywhere else. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter to sign up for the newsletter today and continue to enjoy all our fantastic episodes every Tuesday morning. And by the way, that's Boston Eastern Standard Time. So take care and enjoy this episode. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is David Krantz from david-krantz.com. David, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, man. You're a fascinating dude. You got a lot of things going on, a lot of backgrounds in health and sort of biohacking that fascinate me and that I'm intrigued by, so I'm looking forward to picking your brain and just learning more about some of the things you've done. For the listeners who may not be as familiar with your background and what you do, can you just take about 60 seconds or so and just kind of fill in some blanks and catch them up to speed?
Yeah, absolutely, man. So my background originally is in music and electronic music production. And I found my way into the biohacking world after I had a major kind of health crash a number of years ago. And it was because I was up late partying and touring and playing DJ sets and that kind of thing. And I wasn't taking care of my body. And it kind of forced me to really, you know, either pack up and go home or figure it out. And I got linked up with some pretty interesting people who gave me some resources that, you know, we can talk about today, that I work with clients now. And I consider myself an epigenetic coach because that's the angle that I really take. I look at people's genetics and figure out how they can optimize their genetic expression through kind of a whole systems approach to health.
Cool. I love it. And yeah, you are an epigenetic coach, and you have a number of different areas that you focus on. Did I read correctly, though? Certified epigenetic coach? What is that exactly? How do you get certified doing this kind of thing?
Yes. So right now I only know of one program that is certifying people in this, and this is run by Dr. Daniel Stickler. Are you familiar with Qualia, the Neurohacker Collective supplement?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Okay. They're a pretty big selling nootropic. He's the medical director for them.
Okay.
But he, he's a pretty world renowned guy in the nutrigenomic and nutrigenetic field. And, he's got a training program and, he's a personal friend and mentor of mine. I'm trained through them and certified by them.
Cool. Yeah. We had a couple of guys that did, are focused on like genes in the past, and, the epigenetic part of it, that part is what really fascinates me, because it's like basically you have all these genes, and for years, many years, we all thought, you know, the genes that we had destined us to have a certain or live a certain type of life and, you know, grow up and grow a certain way and have all these different factors that come up. But it's really a lot deeper than that with the epigenetic side of things. You can turn genes on and off you turn genes on and off all the time, and you can completely change the course of your life and your health by doing certain things. And that's really what you focus on, right?
Absolutely, man. Sounds like you've got a really good background and understand that pretty well. That's exactly what I do. I work with people to really figure out what genes might be better off turned on or turned off, and kind of protocols and habits and lifestyle hacks to make that happen for people.
Cool. I want to dive into that in a moment, and some of the epigenetic things that you've learned and some of the different benefits that they have, like knowing certain genes. But this is fascinating too. I mentioned to you before the call, I was on your site before, and I came across something called an anechoic chamber. How does that fit into all this play, and you know, how do you use that? Because I think it goes hand in hand with your background in music, if I'm not correct. And just explain that. How does that work?
Yeah. So to give your listeners a background, an anechoic chamber is a space that has no echo. It's a room that's been acoustically deadened with absorption material. And you'll often see these in research spaces. Most of them are in universities and, kind of private research labs for building speakers or testing airplane noise, that kind of thing. When you really need a really highly tunable room, they're used. And there's not very many of them that are kind of open to the public or used for other things besides research. A couple years ago, I got hooked up with these folks in Asheville, North Carolina. One of them she's an audiologist and a performance expert for the U.S. Air Force. And she had decided that she was going to build an anechoic chamber and put this three-dimensional or 360-degree speaker array in it that you could be suspended in the middle of in a chair and experiment with playing with spatialized sound. And I coincidentally got linked up with her because I went into the clinic to book myself an appointment, and it turned out that they were looking for someone who simultaneously had an interest in health and a knowledge of music production. And I'm trained as an audio engineer. I make electronic music, for my own enjoyment. And it was kind of a natural fit. So I started working with her, and the focus was really on how can you create coherence in the body, better physiological states with sound. And looking at that, you know, similarly, epigenetically, how can you shift genetic expression with sound? So that's what we were working on. And that's what I've been working on in addition to the training that I got as an epigenetic coach. You know, I'll use that with clients sometimes. It's a really relaxing environment. It's kind of, people compare it to a float tank. In a lot of ways, it's kind of like a sensory deprivation chamber. It's completely dark, except that you are floating in a sea of sound. So that's in Asheville, North Carolina. As far as I know, the only space quite like it that exists. It's really pretty an amazing spot.
That's pretty cool. So when you're in this chamber, it's completely dark. And what do you hear anything? Do you hear like your heartbeat? Is that all you can hear? Or like, how does that work?
Yeah. So it's, like I mentioned, there's a 360-degree speaker array. There's 9 speakers arranged kind of in a ball around you. Mm-hmm. And so I write music, and certain frequencies are embedded in the music that bring people into a meditative state kind of automatically using something called brainwave entrainment. If you've heard of like binaural beats,
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a similar process to that, but it's a lot more powerful because we can take advantage of the 3D environment and the physical acoustic space to, say, move sound around the room in a specific pattern that's going to engage different parts of the brain, create coherence between both sides of the brain and that kind of thing.
Okay, so you are actually, you're putting that music on when they're in there. They're not just sitting in there by themselves doing nothing.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's like a musical experience with a specific purpose.
Okay. Have they done when they do, cause I've heard the anechoic chamber. I did a little bit of research, not much, but like, you know, half hour search on Google. They test like different, like you mentioned, testing airplane sounds or, you know, jet sounds. They also test like iPhones and like, I've heard like the iPhone or Apple does it. They do like, they put these phones in, you know, to see how loud the buzzer is or whatever, the ringers. But you're saying you're doing it, you're using it a little differently. You're adding in this binaural type music or sound waves or sound, and you're entraining the brain in a different way than just completely shutting it off like some of these other companies or businesses do.
Yeah, exactly. We're taking advantage of the fact that when you hear the sound from the speaker, it's not bouncing off a wall. It's coming directly at your head. Mm-hmm. And so it creates this really unique acoustic property to the room that, I mean, it creates altered states for people. It's like the closest thing I've found that's not a psychedelic to a psychedelic experience. It's really pretty amazing.
Is it scary at all being in there by yourself? And like, because I've heard, I don't know if this is true either, but I heard that the longest somebody has ever done like this anechoic chamber, been in a chamber, was like maybe 40 minutes or so. And then like after that, you start to go like almost crazy. Is it scary or how does that?
Well, you know, we've taken ours down just a little bit of a notch so that doesn't happen for people. It's not as full of a like full on dead end room as a lot of other spaces. It gets the effect, but it doesn't create that anxiety for people. So we kind of chose somewhere in between that like research grade anechoic chamber and something that's, a little bit more approachable. And, you know, I mean, I guess if you're afraid of the dark, it could be scary, but for most people, it's pretty relaxing.
Okay. No, that's pretty cool. So why is it that after, was it, by the way, do you know what the number is? Like how long someone has stayed in a chamber by themselves? What's the number and why would that even be scary? Like just being alone by yourself?
Yeah, I think it's because it's just such a strange experience and you get totally thrown into, just the only thing that you can hear is your own biological sounds. Like you said, your heartbeat, blood rushing, and I guess it just drives people nuts.
Wow. It's just probably so different to all five senses that it's like, you know, it completely throws your mind into, it's like another place. Like you're just not familiar with that place perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine, I mean, I'm trying to just imagine maybe like the visual equivalent if you were in just like a super blindingly bright room or something like that, where it's like sensory overload, something like that.
Yeah, almost being thrown into like another dimension. Like you remember the Simpsons episode 20 years ago, whatever, where Bart's like in that. I think it was Bart or Homer. They're in like that, you know, the little shape of like the wormhole or something like that. You know what I'm talking about? They're walking through, and it's I don't know, horrible analogy, but I think you get the point where it's like.
You know, I've seen so many Simpsons episodes, and I want to say I know it's exactly when you're talking. And the one that comes up for me is where Homer's lost in the desert, and he picks up the turtle.
I think that's what I'm talking about, like, yeah. And he's in, like, a completely different place, like that, being in another dimension.
So it's it's the one where he eats the super hot pepper at the chili cook-off.
Yeah,
and it sends him on like a psychedelic trip. Yeah,
okay. I'm glad you get it. I'm glad you. People are probably listening, like younger people, like Simpsons. Who the hell watches that show? Back in the day, it was a great show, and I'm glad you get the reference. But so it sounds like it's pretty cool. It's actually something like that I want to do. So have you done it? And oh, by the way, do you know how long someone has stayed? Was it like 40 minutes or so?
You know, that sounds about right. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but that
I thought
seems
it was
about
like 40
right.
40 minutes. Okay. That sounds like something I want to do. Have you done this yourself? Do you go in there like occasionally? And if so, what do you do? Like, why are you going in there? For the meditative benefits of it, the brain benefits?
Yeah, well, you know, I go in there to write the program. So as I'm, mixing things, like I'll write some of the music at home in my studio, but then I'll take it in there to mix. So I'm sitting in the center of this chamber, actively mixing it, moving sound around to make sure that the effects that I want are the ones I'm getting. And I've actually put myself in some pretty weird states in there where I've done some things where I said, oh yeah, that probably shouldn't be, I shouldn't play that for people. Cause you know, it has the possibility, like you said, to you know, create anxiety or states like that just as much as it does for relaxation and meditation purposes. But yeah, when I go in there and I just do a session, it's like, I want to chill out. I want to have a relaxing experience. Maybe I want to think and like process something, you know, kind of get deeper into the unconscious a little bit. It's good for that kind of thing.
That's pretty cool. Can you just get up and leave whenever you want, or is there someone that has to like watch you through a secret camera in the side of the room, or like how does that work? Are you like trapped in there if you forget to get out or what?
We actually have a little remote that you can hit a button and it'll call someone, because the way it works is there's this like perfect spot in the center of it. It's about a foot and a half in diameter. And if you get your head in that spot, it just sounds amazing. It's like, I don't know, the most amazing stereo system you've ever heard, like times 10. And in order to do that, we actually have a wench that lifts up a recliner that allows you to position your head like that. So you're kind of floating. And if you tried to get out of it in the dark, it wouldn't be good. So, you know, we have a remote. You can call someone if there's any reason to stop it in the middle.
Is it set pre-programmed for, say, like 20 minutes or half hour beforehand?
Yeah. Their sessions are usually 40 minutes to an hour, depending on which one.
Oh, okay. Wow, that is so cool, dude. Like, the closest thing I can think of me doing, I haven't done the float tank before, I haven't done this, but the closest thing I think is a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. I did that.
Oh, cool.
That's pretty cool, too. Like, for people who have claustrophobia at all, like, that can be pretty intense. Like, especially if you're in, like, the big ones, the solid steel ones or whatever they're made. I think it's steel. Solid steel, and there's basically just like a tiny little window, like the top of the corner of the room, and then everything else is just sealed in. Then you have like the pressure coming in. It's pretty intense, but this sounds even like more intense. This is something I want to do.
Did you like the hyperbaric oxygen?
I did, actually. I did. I found it like, because for me, I'm sort of a little claustrophobic, not really bad where it's like a problem, but you know, I don't really love like elevators and things like that, but you know, I still do them. It's not really a big deal. But for me, someone who has like a little bit of claustrophobia, the first like day, 2 days was like a little tough. It was like a little, you know, challenging. But after that, once you get used to it, like anything else, it's, you know, it's nothing. I brought in a book and I've, you know, read the book, and it was just a pretty meditative, relaxing kind of experience for about an hour. Mm-hmm. Did it for a month.
Cool. Were you doing it for a specific reason with like your health, or I'm just curious to know more about your experience.
Yeah, well, basically headaches. So like migraine type things. That's really why I did it. Like had a couple past TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, small ones. Mm-hmm. But I think my guess is that they've led into some migraines that I get periodically. So a couple of years back, I was doing some research. I actually had a guy by the name of Dr. Paul Harch, and he was on the show. He's like the worldwide leader in HBOT, hyperbaric oxygen therapy treatment. He was like the kind of the pioneer of it. He told me all about it and stuff. And it was something that really helps out with people who've had like past TBIs and mm-hmm. who might have like headaches and migraines that were related to that. So I tried it out and, you know, I enjoyed it. I did like it.
Awesome, man. Well, yeah, if you're ever in the area, we'll get you in the chamber.
Yeah. What is a session cost, by the way? Like, is this, cause that's the thing with the hyperbaric thing, man. It's really cool, but it's also really expensive. Is this pretty expensive too?
$100 a session.
Okay. That's not too bad. I think, I forget the exact cost of the hyperbaric. That was like 300 or 250 or 300 a session, something like that. So that's not bad.
Yeah, fortunately, we don't have to like pressurize our room or anything. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into to those things. But yeah, no, it's definitely something I want to do. It's very fascinating. The other thing with the binaural beats, not even what did you call them exactly? Because you said it's better than binaural beats. Because the binaural beats, I know about those because they used to add those into hypnosis MP3s that I used to listen to. Dr. Andrew Dobson, this guy that I always recommend on the show, he's one of my favorite hypnotists. He had these certain CDs back in the day, MP3s, and they would add in these binaural beats at the beginning of the session, and those got you your brain like really in tuned and like in a meditative state. And then he would throw in the hypnosis stuff, and it was the best CDs, MP3s I found. And I think it was because of the binaural beats that he added to it. But what do you call yours specifically?
Yeah, so I use isochronic beats. It's very similar, just kind of a different method. Instead of having to listen on headphones and split it between two ears, you're able to do it in a in speakers through the air. And then the other really unique thing is being able to like move sound around the room, be able to spin things and have unique patterns that kind of take advantage of your brain's spatialization ability and the ability to know where sound is coming from, and kind of hacks into that system a little bit.
What's the science behind that? Did you just kind of stumble upon this one day, or did somebody that you like your mentor stumble upon this, or has there been like science for years that like show sound affects the brain in a certain way, and then like spinning it this way or coming in at different angles? Or different sounds and like different tempos to it. Where does that come from? Where is the science behind that, and why does it actually work in the brain?
Yeah. So two answers to that. One is that there's a really rich body of research around brainwave entrainment and the capacity of the brain to tune into those sounds. And that's where the isochronic beats come from. As far as the spatialization piece, that's one of the things that we're actively working on and figuring out on our own, kind of. Adding to the research and working and figuring that out. So a lot of that is experimental, and we've had some pretty good results as far as people's experience with it.
Do you ever hook people up to like what are they called, EEGs and different things like that, where you can actually study their brain waves in real time while they're undergoing this treatment?
Yeah, we've done a little bit of that, and we're hoping to do a little bit more of a formal study at some point to generate some more peer-reviewed kind of validated data. But the initial stuff that we've done is pretty strong in terms of just looking at hemispheric coherence between both sides of the brain, getting those to talk a little bit more, which is what you really see in like long-term meditators and people that have a pretty strong background in that kind of thing.
Okay. Is it similar to neurofeedback too, like what you're doing?
Similar in certain ways. We're not getting the feedback so much of it, but it does have some of the same effects in terms of turning on certain parts of the brain and moving different brain waves into different states.
Cool. And the final thing on this, and I do want to move on, and because I wanted to focus mostly on the genes today, but this stuff is really fascinating. But the final thing on this, so it's good for meditative like states, it's good for expanding your consciousness. What types of conditions do people come in to treat or perhaps reverse or alleviate? What are some of the people that are coming in there? What are they doing to, and why are they coming in there?
Well, I'll tell you the most striking story I have from it. And that's a woman, she's in her 60s, and she's actually, I won't give her name away, but she's a pretty well-known entrepreneur, built up a pretty big Silicon Valley company, sold it, I think, for like $400 million, something like that. Wow. And she had a stroke about 10 years ago. And she came in and started working with the chamber. And after two or three sessions, I think it was after three sessions, she told me that this was the first thing that she's tried. And, she has infinite resources money-wise. This was the first thing that she tried that like totally got her memory back online from the stroke, which was, amazing. And so that's definitely the biggest thing that I've seen. Other people come in just to experience it a lot of the time, and anyone that just wants a little bit more kind of balance in their life and flow, or just to have a really kind of cool experience.
Okay, so it's still experimental in terms of what conditions it can treat. Obviously, like you don't know exactly what it is, what it can treat or even reverse right now, but it seems like it can help a vast number of things, and especially everyday use, like general people. I mean, this seems really cool, man. I'm very fascinating and definitely looking forward to hearing more and kind of seeing where you take the research.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm looking forward to kind of pursuing it and seeing where it goes as well.
All right, so nutrigenomics, what is that exactly? Why do you study it? What does it affect, and what can we learn about this?
Yeah, absolutely, man. So nutrigenomics is the study of how different foods and herbs and substances affect genetic expression. So how a certain herb might turn on certain genes, turn them off, or certain foods And that's a little bit different than nutrigenetics. And I just want to make that distinction for your listeners, because they're two terms that are really similar. And most people haven't really heard of them because they're really new, especially because we really only have been able to look at this stuff pretty recently. You know, we only mapped the genome about 16, 17 years ago, and we only have a body of research now where we can really start to, you know, look at this data recently. And nutrigenetics is the study of how your genes affect the way you respond to food. So like, I'll give you an example. There's a gene called BCO1, and this gene codes for an enzyme that breaks down or converts beta carotene into the active form of vitamin A in your body, which is retinol. And you actually can't make the active form of vitamin A without this enzyme. You have to be able to convert it. And so some people have lower amounts of this enzyme naturally. And I think oftentimes these are the people that try a vegan diet and, you know, end up crashing after a few years and really have to, you know, kind of reconsider things. Because the active form of vitamin A is going to be found in mostly animal foods. And so with someone with a low amount of this enzyme, you can look at this gene, you can look at certain part variants in this gene and kind of predict, hey, you're going to have less of this enzyme. And so for someone like that, you might want to eat more liver because that's really high in active vitamin A. And now that's opposed to nutrigenomics, where you might want to, you're going to want to eat something that is going to specifically shift certain genes. And I'll give you kind of a negative example of that. There's a gene called APOE, and this gene has been really well studied as far as cognitive decline. People with a certain variant are more likely to experience cognitive decline and Alzheimer's, that kind of thing. But it seems to be turned on mostly by saturated fat in the diet. So as long as those people aren't eating a diet that's high in saturated fat, they tend to have kind of a normalized risk. But you know, if they eat saturated fat, it actually changes the way that gene expresses. So that's nutrigenomics, and you know, that's kind of what I do with clients and help them understand what these different variants that they have are and customize their diet so that they get the optimal genetic expression there.
Okay, so let me see if I get this right. I think I'm going to butcher it, but nutrigenetics is basically looking at the genes themselves, and then nutrigenomics is looking at the way they're expressed. Is that right?
In a way, yeah. It's more about how you'd handle it. It's like the say like nutrigenetics is sort of making up for a deficit, and nutrigenomics is actually changing the expression. So you don't have to make up for it in a way.
Okay, gotcha. And the APOE thing, that is very interesting, of course. You know, we've talked about that in the past. There's two, maybe even more APOEs, as far as I know, APOE3 and APOE4. APOE3, mm-hmm. I believe, is the one that makes people susceptible to getting Alzheimer's, correct?
It's the 4. It's the 4 variant.
Is it the 4? Okay, it's mm-hmm. 4. And then yeah, what's the 3? The 3 is a little different.
Yeah, so there's 2, 3, and 4. And when you look at the APOE gene, it's actually a combination of two different variants. So you can be a 3-3, a 3-4, a 2-4, a 4-4, any combination of those. And the 3-3 is the most common. Most people are going to be 3-3s. They carry kind of the normalized risk. The 2s, they actually tend to carry a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. And then the 4s, either the 3-4 or the 4-4 is going to have that elevated risk, and they need to be, you know, especially mindful of saturated fat and really exercising. Exercise is another big factor for those folks.
Quick Start makes organic snacks with cricket powder and plant-based ingredients. This cricket powder is made from organically farmed, free-range crickets. Their other ingredients include foods like seed butters, hemp, chocolate, and dates that are all organic too. The bars are delicious, better than so many other protein/meal replacement bars I've had, and have absolutely none of that chalky taste you usually get in those bars. I actually really love these things. And yes, I know what you're thinking, Justin, seriously, crickets, dude? What's the deal with that? And trust me, I thought the same thing at first, but once I tried my first bar, I was absolutely amazed at how good these things really were, and after that, it became completely normal for me to put down a few of these bars throughout the day, and also some of their delicious cricket pack crackers for that matter too. Quick Start bars have a very balanced macronutrient profile, so they make a good pre- or post-workout snack, or even just a snack at the office or on the go. I was blown away by the nutrition facts panel on these products. You can check them out for yourself on the QuickStart.com website. What's great about Crickets is that they're high in protein, twice as much as beef or chicken, with all 9 essential amino acids necessary for muscle growth and repair, among other things, and in vitamin B12 and iron. So they provide all the nutrition you get from meat without many of their downsides. For the same amount of protein compared to beef, Crickets require 12 times less feed, 2,000 times less water, thousands of times less land, and they emit 100 times less greenhouse gases. There are over 40 Crickets in every Quick Start bar and over 100 in every cracker bag. And trust me when I tell you this, they taste delicious. Visit QuickStart.com right now and get your very own Quick Start bars and snacks and use the coupon code ELITE at checkout to get 20% off your purchase. Again, that's QuickStart.com and the coupon code is ELITE for 20% off. I believe the APOE4 then, the one for Alzheimer's, that's the gene that they basically get Alzheimer's more at a higher rate than other people just because I believe they have a higher rate of inflammation throughout the body. Like their body naturally tends to be more inflamed, and that can go back, you know, thousands of years where that inflammation was actually needed in these people, in our ancestors, or, you know, these people's ancestors were being more inflamed, like having sort of a tougher environment to live in. They developed this gene, but nowadays it's like they have all this extra inflammation. It's leading to a lot of like brain inflammation, and that's what kind of causes the Alzheimer's. Is that right?
Yeah, man, that's such a good point. I love that because that's really what the crux of it is that it's about matching your genes to the correct environment. And, you know, a lot of these variants that people consider to be negative or risk oriented, they, you know, gave people a survival advantage at some point in history. And, you know, I think it's really important to reframe that. Because none of these things are, you know, like a death sentence. None of these things are saying like you have this thing and you can't do anything about it. It's more about finding the right environment that's going to, you know, lead to the right expression for you. I'll give you a pretty neat example. There's a gene called HFE. And people with certain variant carry a risk for what they call hemochromatosis or excess iron in the blood. Yep. And there's a lot of people who have that risk, but during the Middle Ages and medieval times, during the bubonic plague, that variant actually gave people a survival advantage. And so there was kind of a bottleneck in the human genome where more people survived the plague that had that particular HFE variant. And so that's why you see it, you know, pretty strongly in European descended populations. You know, now it can, you know, give people excess iron, but at that point it was a total survival advantage.
What did the excess iron back then do to help them survive?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know that much about the actual pathogen that was causing that disease, but
that's
I just know
that. Yeah, that is very interesting because, I mean, it makes a lot of sense too because, you know, we do need iron in our body. Iron does a lot of things. Unfortunately, though, like, you know, it can go the other way too, especially in this day and age where we're eating a ton of meat and, you know, there's hidden iron in a lot of things too. A lot of the time people have excess iron and it does negative things. Like it can, you know, cause different inflammation. It can, you know, hold different types of things. It can feed different viruses and things like that, like heavy metals. So, yeah, man, there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. Looking back to it, it's like, why do we have this gene? Why do we have that gene? But, you know, you dig a few hundred years back, a few thousand years back, it made a lot of sense. This specific gene helped people live. It helped people survive different types of environments and climates. What is a couple of the other ones too that stick out? Is there any other big ones that gene wise that, you know, that stick out to be beneficial or non beneficial or maybe something that people should look into testing for?
Yeah, I mean there's a number of them. Let's see. One of my favorites is this one called PPARGC1A, PPARGC1A, and it's a big player in mitochondrial function and mitochondrial biogenesis, which is the ability to create new mitochondria. And people with a certain variant of it are either going to be, you know, better at creating new mitochondria, especially in response to cold, in response to cold exposure. Probably imagine you're familiar with like Wim Hof.
Yeah, I just had him on the show.
Oh, cool.
A couple weeks ago, yeah.
Awesome. How was that interview?
Who's awesome, man. He's a really cool dude.
Yeah.
Funny,
I'd love
funny,
to look
entertaining. Yeah.
I'd love to know what his PPAR-GC1A variant is, because people with so people with this with one variant respond really well to cold, and they're able to turn on their mitochondria and produce more heat, produce more mitochondria, and then people on the other side of things don't respond very well at all. And so there's the people that just like never really adapt to the cold, and you know there's people that are kind of in the middle. I'm kind of in the middle. I have the heterozygous variant, meaning I have one allele of one and one of the other, and I do okay with it. My wife has the really good good gene for that one, and I've been doing cold exposure like for 2 years, and she just started about 2 months ago, and she can stay in longer than I can now.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. So I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, that sucks. I mean, in that case, being I'm sure you're pretty competitive, having her come in a month later and already beating you. But that's very interesting. So, in terms of we have these genes like Wim Hof. Probably, I mean, I think it's very likely that he's on the other end of the spectrum, like your wife, like super, super good at just turning that gene on and heating up his body and being able to sustain unbelievably cold, like -4 degrees, I think, or something. He ran a marathon in. I mean, that's ridiculous.
It's amazing.
Hiking up mountains in shorts and, you know, no shoes and just shorts on or something, no shirt. Guy's insane. But having that type of susceptibility to expressing these genes versus, say, you or I, who maybe, you know, just have regular genes, where does it come into play then where you can express these genes or not express these genes and just be able to still do something? Like, in other words, how do you get past what you're given and, you know, still thrive in an environment where you're not necessarily predisposed to expressing a certain type of gene, like, say, Wim Hof? How do you, because he trains people, by the way, he trains people all the time in how to learn his techniques and how to go out in the cold and do this stuff. So if those people don't have the genes that he has, how are they able to do it?
Yeah. I think there's always an available ability to put mind over matter in a lot of those cases. Mm-hmm. And the body is really adaptive and resilient. And, you know, you can adapt and change. If someone, you know, has the complete opposite, alleles that he has, maybe they'll never be able to go to -4, but maybe they can expand their capacity from, you know, taking 30 seconds of a cold shower to being able to do an ice bath for 5 or 10 minutes, you know? And so it's different looking at different ranges. But then the question is, you know, what are you really trying to achieve with something like that? And when you look at someone who has the PPAR-GC1A variant that doesn't do well in cold, well, what are the other things that you can do to improve mitochondrial function? And, you know, for those people, high-intensity exercise might be a better choice, because you get kind of similar response. You create a whole lot of new mitochondria in response to exercise. So that's the thing about epigenetics, is it's this multifactorial approach. Most of the time, there's not just one thing that you can do to, say, turn on or off a specific gene. There's all of these different factors that can come into play. So you can do it with diet as well, like omega-3 fats tend to activate that gene as well. You might be able to use certain supplements that target mitochondrial health. So really, you know, trying to have as many layers to what you're trying to achieve there is going to, you know, create the quickest and most beneficial effects. And really, when I work with clients, like, that's what I try and focus on, is like the whole systems approach, not just isolating it and looking at one variable, which I think really is kind of the future in terms of how we see health. You know, the traditional medical system in the United States really likes to look at things in a reductionist manner, likes to have a pill that does one thing. And when you can really start to hit things from multiple angles, that's when you start to see, you know, amazing results happen quickly. And it's like for you with hyperbaric oxygen, you could do that. You can stack a bunch of other things on top of it that also might influence, which I imagine you probably, you know, did for your migraines, right? Like, it was, that probably wasn't the only thing you tried.
Yeah.
And so You know, so I like to think about it in terms of all of these different inputs that might have similar results, and then how can you leverage them so that you're really exponentially increasing the effectiveness of them.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that's actually a great point you make too. It's not just like there's one gene that controls, say, mitochondria, or one gene that controls inflammation. There's like, what, hundreds, thousands of different genes or variables that influence specific actions or outcomes in the body. And so like hitting them, like you said, on different angles can, like if you don't have this Wim Hof gene where you can run in marathons in -4 degrees, you can still influence that through diet, through exercise, through other ways. You can, you know, hit that mitochondria. Obviously, there's so many different things with mitochondria, even like light therapy, photobiomodulation, you know, fish oils, turmeric, curcumin, like different things like that would certainly improve mitochondria. CoQ10 types of, like those types of things, even, you know, meditation and things like that could have an effect. And, you know, theoretically, I don't know for sure, but it could have an effect on like your mitochondria and how they, you know, get stronger or whatever, how they function. There's so many different things, but that's a great point you make. I was just kind of thinking on the outside too, just like thinking like, oh yeah, you have this gene or that gene. And then like, you kind of just dialed me back in that there's so many different more factors than just what the gene say or just what one gene says, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's so pertinent and so true. And one of the things I really do want to stress to your audience is that you can't, for the most part, really isolate these things down to one gene. It's a network, and they all interact, and they're all communicating with each other and signaling to each other in ways that is, you know, really pretty complex. So, you know, you might look at one variant that you have and focus on it, but then it can be helpful to kind of look at things in a network, see how they interact. And, you know, it's kind of the omnigenic approach, is looking at, you know, not just one gene, not even just two or three, but really trying to see how many different factors are going to come into play at once.
Yeah. And then just kind of hitting those hitting as many of those as possible. What are the tests that you give to your clients when they come to you? What are some of the big ones that stick out? What are some of the genes that you test for?
So I tend to, I don't really like to look at things in isolation. I'll run a panel on clients, and I usually kind of break them up into categories in terms of like nutrition-based genes or exercise-based genes or sleep genes. And it's, I mean, honestly, it's almost useless to look at just one, you know, like you can look at one. Like, people get really focused on this one called MTHFR. People really like to focus on that one, but there's so many more factors that go into like the methylation cycle that you can get really, you know, blinders on when people start looking at that. So, I'll look at, you know, at minimum 40, 50 genes in the same kind of panel and kind of weight them almost like you would, you know, do a pro and con list, where you make a mark and you know that something is weighted this way, and then you just keep kind of seeing how many, all of these things, how they stack up. And, you know, really it's in line with what's going on in the most kind of up-to-date relevant scientific research. And they usually call that like a polygenic score, risk score, where you're assessing, you know, multiple variables and really seeing how they affect the whole picture.
Okay.
But but in general, in terms of testing, you know, I'll look at genes, maybe do a little bit of lab testing, especially to track things over time in terms of how, you know, certain interventions or protocols are working.
Yep. Is there a specific like test kit that you'll order, like a, you know, company that sticks out or something like that? Because the guy that I had on the show probably, what, 6 months or so ago now, was a guy named Dr. Dan Reardon. And he actually owns the, I wish I could remember the actual, his company name, but I should probably remember that. But he did a test on me. He tested like 40 different genes. And a couple of things that stick out for that was I have the clock gene, which is the sleep gene. I am a slow metabolizer of caffeine, which means it stays in my system like all day. I don't even use caffeine, but if I did, it would stay in my system. There was a couple other ones, like I'm a bad transitioner from burning fats to carbs, so kind of like the process of that is slow. You know, some people kind of go in and out or whatever. They can burn fats really well and then carbs. I don't particularly I'm not particularly good with switching systems, but I can, you know, burn. I usually have a fast metabolism. But yeah, those are a couple of things that stick out.
Answer your question in terms of the testing. I'm affiliated with a company called Apeiron, Apeiron Genomics, and we do a private test through a lab that we run. You know, I was using 23andMe for a while, but there's so many issues with who owns what data and where is it going that we decided to contract with a private lab, and we actually can look at a lot more variants than we could get with 23andMe. So when I do a full comprehensive read on people, I'm looking at about 500 different genes, nutrition panels, probably about 70 or 80. Sleep is probably about 30. Kind of depends on what you're looking at and really what the research out there is available. And you know, the cool thing too is that the guy I'm trained by, Dr. Dan Stickler, he's been using this stuff in his clinical practice for about seven, eight years. And there's just not a lot of people that have really been doing it that long. I'll give you an example. He told me that he went to the Conference of Nutrigenomics, I think it was in 2015, and there were 600 different researchers there, and he was one of three clinicians. So, wow. You know, when you see stuff that's like a direct-to-consumer test, you know, like Helix or, you know, a lot of the other ones where you can just, they'll give you a report. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff is just based on the research that's out there. It doesn't have necessarily the clinical experience to back it up. So I have the benefit of kind of inheriting all of this clinical research on thousands or clinical experience of a couple thousand clients in addition to kind of comparing it with the research. So, you know, I feel pretty fortunate that I got linked up with the right people with this.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So if somebody wanted to get a complete panel like Dr. Stickler would order if you went to him or you, what would that cost, getting like all these genes tested?
Right now, for me, it'd be around $1,000 just for the panels. And then I also work with people on a coaching capacity over a period of time to kind of continue to integrate and add new, you know, techniques and protocols in, because there's so much information that comes back. It's like kind of insane to try and just overhaul your entire life based on it all at once. So what I do as a coach is, you know, I figure out what the highest impact things are that people can do right away, and then continue to add more things or change things, tweak things over time based on the genetic data.
Is there anything that you see in the future potentially being an issue or something that, you know, you might not have down right now that could change? Like, this is a science, like you said, it's just pretty brand new. I mean, there's so many different things that are coming out. Even the Human Genome Project, they're still learning so much more about the genes. Is there anything that you see coming up that could potentially be wrong in the future, or could steer, not maybe not wrong, but steer you in a different direction where people are thinking one thing now, but in like, you know, 5-10 years, they might be thinking something different?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that science is always evolving, and there's, you know, it's based on the best evidence that we have available. You know, the idea of science being fact is not really quite true. It's our best understanding of what's available. So things are always going to evolve and change. And as far as things that I think are, you know, potential issues or just things that I'm looking at, I'm really curious about CRISPR technology and the ability to edit the genome and how that is going to, or change those different variants that we're talking about, being able to edit, you know, different letters into the code. Because there's a whole, I mean, it's very attractive. It's really interesting. You know, there's people that are trying it. You can get an at-home CRISPR kit and do it on yourself for like $200. It's pretty.
They're already doing that now, editing their own genes.
Yep, absolutely.
Wow. That's sounds pretty dangerous.
Yes, there are biohackers that are doing it, and you know, we'll see what happens.
That sounds don't get me wrong. That sounds dangerous, but pretty freaking cool. Like that. That is pretty badass if they're already able to do it. And if they're able to do it even somewhat successfully, that's incredible.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the one to do it, but I will gladly sit back and eat some popcorn and watch and see what happens.
Yeah, I'll wait like 5 years and see how these guys turn out. If they're still alive, maybe I'll consider it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there's a There's a woman named Liz Parrish who owns a big biotech company. It's in Argentina, some branch in South America, but she's famous for doing some gene editing on herself and actually monitoring stuff, you know, in a really super comprehensive way to see how that's turned out for her. And she's actually had really good results with it. And so that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah,
and you know, I mean, we're going to reach a point where it's going to be, you know, standard practice, and then you get into the idea of designer babies and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and then you get into the ethics of, you know, if you can prevent a disease by editing an embryo's genome, you know, are you obligated to do it to prevent, you know, some kind of debilitating disease? And you know, I think there's a whole lot of unknowns with that. And, you know, I tread lightly in that territory, but I'm really interested by it to see what happens.
No, seriously, man. I'll tread lightly in that territory myself, but I am very fascinated with that. But there's so many different things that can go bad or wrong with that. Like, even just thinking about the editing of your babies. And, I mean, I can just foresee right now people like, basically like going on a video game or something, and you're like creating, you know, like the football games, the basketball games,
you like create, add different stats.
Yeah. Or create these players that were like, you know, 7 feet tall and like 400 pounds, like all muscle, and they go in the game and then dominate, and they'd have like, you know, your last name on their jersey.
Yeah, right. But, like, you want your child to be like the Madden super
like
freak.
The Madden super freak who's on every cover and, you know, scores 50 touchdowns every game. But yeah, it's just basically like you can pick out the eye color, you can pick out the height, the hair color, the nose shape, like everything. And I don't know, that just sounds crazy, but that's probably what they're going to be able to do, you know, 50, 100 years from now. But even right now, so Liz Parrish, she has been able to edit her own genes. How does that work? Like, when you get this kit for a couple hundred bucks, well, she might have been doing it a little bit differently, but if you get this kit for a couple hundred bucks, how does that actually work? Are you just like, I have no idea how this editing thing works.
Yeah, so they've basically hijacked a virus. They've kind of taken a virus that inserts itself into the genome and kind of co-opted it so that they can tell it where exactly to go and exactly what alleles in the gene, or the letters, you know, A, T, C, or G, exactly which ones to swap out where. And my understanding is that it works pretty well. There might be some things that don't quite go well, but, you know, the question with it is, you know, what are the unseen downstream effects that we're not able to predict because we can't know everything? It's like, are you familiar with like the cane toad problem in Australia?
No, I haven't heard of that.
Okay, so I believe it was in the 60s or 70s, they introduced all of these toads into Australia because they were trying to take care of some other invasive animal that, you know, maybe it was rats or something like that, that these toads would eat. And they thought, well, if we introduce these toads into the environment, they'll take care of these other things, and we can, you know, eliminate this other population of these animals we don't want. I forget what they were trying to get rid of. But now cane toads are completely covering Australia. Like, people run them over with their cars.
Wow.
If you type in cane toads Australia to Google, it's ridiculous. It's like the biggest population explosion ever.
Wow.
Because they just didn't see it coming. And so I just, you know, when you look at the nonlinear nature of biological systems, there's always things that humans are not going to be able to predict. And when you mess with the dynamics of something like the genome, it's kind of hard to know what's going to happen. So that's one of the reasons I'm treading lightly for myself personally.
Yeah. The fact that people are already doing that, like biohackers are doing that on the side, is crazy. But hey, better them than me or you. You know what I mean? Let these guys do it and figure it out. And then, you know, hopefully in a few years, everybody else can kind of figure it out as well, just by their experiences. Hopefully it's not too bad, but we'll see. It's dangerous. I mean, you know, you're editing your genes. Like, that is, it's pretty serious stuff. And I don't think they figured it out to the point where they know this and this is going to happen, or like, you know, it's still very experimental. So I don't know. It's, you know, these people are very ballsy, but I mean, I'll give them credit, but also I don't think it's the smartest thing in the world right now anyways.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing though, is when you look back, you know, we're in a time where Everything has to be done with clinical trials and super, you know, oversight. But a lot of a lot of major medical breakthroughs in history have been done from people experimenting on themselves, and, you know, surgeries and that type of things. There's a whole rich history of kind of early biohackers saying, well, if no one else is going to try this, the ethics of it are, if I hurt myself, I didn't hurt anyone else. So, you know, it's at least, you know, it's interesting.
No, these guys are the total pioneers, man. I love that they do this stuff. I just don't encourage it for the listeners because, you know, most people probably shouldn't be doing it. But no, I love the fact that there are people doing this right now, that there are people, there's crazy biohackers out there that are buying these kits for a couple hundred bucks and, you know, running these own tests on themselves, because they're literally the people that change the world. They're literally the people that make all those crazy breakthroughs. And, you know, 5, 10, 20 years from now, when this stuff is mainstream, it's because of those guys. It's not because of the people in the labs, you know, just reading the same old papers from 50, 60 years ago and doing the same old shit. It's the people that actually are willing to try something new and, you know, have some courage to go out there and be bold.
Yeah, for sure, man. And in some cases, it's people finding papers from 50, 60 years ago that everyone else ignored because it was out of line with the paradigm at the time, and finding those papers and saying, huh, this actually had some good ideas in it. Maybe we should revisit that, and, you know, going from there. So, but yeah, I have a lot of respect for those people. But like I said, I'll sit back and eat some popcorn and watch.
David, just a couple quick questions, and then we'll wrap things up, man. It's been an awesome interview. I really appreciate it. You talk about, I believe, circadian epigenetics. What is that exactly, and how can we use that to get better performance in health and fitness and life?
Yeah, man. So circadian rhythm is how your body biologically changes over the course of a day, and everything in our body is timed. And a lot of the times we don't really think about the time dynamic of all the processes in our body, but, you know, every chemical reaction, every enzyme, every time we, you know, there's a time dimension to it. And so we have these genes called circadian genes that kind of switch on other genes, switch them on and off throughout the day. And under ideal circumstances, like, it's a normal, regular 24-hour cycle. Give you an example. Melatonin is, you know, a major sleep hormone, and ideally it should be released around, you know, 11, 12 at night in order to really optimize sleep. And on the flip side of that, you have cortisol, and melatonin and cortisol have this inverse relationship where one tends to suppress the other. So, you know, at night when you're going to sleep, you don't want a lot of cortisol. And cortisol it's a stress hormone, but it's also just an activating hormone. It's what you need to, you know, get yourself up and going. And in the morning, you get a cortisol spike. So ideally, when your circadian rhythm is firing correctly, you're releasing hormones at the right time of day. You're producing chemicals at the right time of day, neurotransmitters, enzymes, all of those things are being conducted like a symphony orchestra that's in sync with itself. And I mean, you know what it sounds like when a band isn't playing together well. It sucks. No one wants to listen to that. And that's, you know, oftentimes what happens for people when, you know, you have a disease process going on, or you have low energy and fatigue, that there's circadian dysregulation happening. And, you know, we're talking on computers right now, we're looking at screens, and the blue light coming from these screens is one of the things that tends to really kind of screw up circadian rhythm, because one of the big things that sets it is actually light. You know, you got to think about our ancestors 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, they would have only been ever exposed to natural light from the sun. And so the way that the human system evolved was in concert with sunlight during the day and then almost no light at night. And when you disrupt the natural frequencies of light that you're getting, it can throw that off. And we tend to be very sensitive to blue light because it's very rare in nature. It happens, you know, when, like, the sun is setting and you kind of just see that nice flash of blue light right before it gets real dark, that, like, deep kind of bright midnight blue thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be the signal to the human body that, okay, the sun is going down. It's time to start a different hormone pattern. It's time to regulate these circadian genes. And we're kind of bombarding our systems with weird frequencies of light all the time at different times of day. And so that's one of the big things I stress with my clients is like having a healthy light diet in order to optimize the circadian rhythm there.
Cool. No, that makes a ton of sense. And we've talked about stuff like that in the past too. And unfortunately, like we live in this society where it's like a lot of blue lights are emitted from our cell phones, our laptops, our televisions, all these things. We're constantly surrounded by it. But, you know, just having like good practices of diminishing that closer and closer to bed, or giving yourself an hour or two window of no blue light right before sleep. And then, of course, like, yeah, you can have it during the day. You can go outside and get natural, regular light. And, you know, it fixes or corrects that system. Something I have to work on. By the way, I had that clock gene, which makes me susceptible to having a messed up circadian rhythm. So, I mean, I kind of play on that and just, you know, use it as an excuse to be a night owl a lot. But I have to actually correct that myself and eventually get back to, like, more of a normal, quote-unquote, schedule. So even for me, it's something that I could benefit from and, you know, doing less blue light at night and just more natural light during the day, I think would benefit me and you know, most listeners out there.
Yeah, I think it's kind of one of those hidden things that goes under the radar for a lot of people. But for me personally, like I'm pretty religious about it these days, just because when I've tracked stuff over time, I've noticed that my sun exposure throughout the day is one of the biggest things that changes my mood and like my ability to concentrate and focus. And when I go out, you know, if I let that go for like, you know, a couple days or a week, I really start to see the difference from it and just feel a little bit more dull and less present.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's pretty powerful. And there's something too about just the natural healing properties or components of being outside and in nature, in touch with nature. And then of course that light, the sunlight especially, it has a lot of healing, I think, undiscovered properties even now, that there's something to that, man. There's really something just like innately beneficial being outside and being in the light. But David, man, it's been a fantastic interview. I really appreciate it. I feel like we could probably talk for a couple more hours about just random shit and cool biohacking stuff. But just kind of wrapping things up, what is a send-off message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out more about your work?
A send-off. Man, just be curious, you know, stay curious and, you know, let your curiosity lead you to new things, and don't be afraid of putting something down to pick something else up. That's one of the big things that I've discovered in my life, is it's okay to realize that, hey, I'm actually more interested in this other new thing that I really want to discover. And allowing that curiosity to guide me has been really important. And I think that's one of the, you know, kind of common factors between people who do really cool, interesting things, is that they just, you know, don't ever lose sight of that curiosity.
And then what's the website?
Website is david-krantz, krantz.com. And if anyone's interested in getting in contact with me for a consultation, you want to look deeper into your genes, you know, feel free to shoot me a message and we'll talk.
Awesome. David, thanks again, man, for coming on. Really appreciate it. I know our guys are going to absolutely love this one. I had a great time. We're going to have to get you back on and talk some more biohacking stuff in the near future. But until then, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Hey, if you love the Elite Man podcast, one of the best things you can do to help support the show is simply tell a few of your friends about us. That's right. By sharing the Elite Man podcast with one or more of your buddies, you can give them the awesome tools and resources you get each week and help us out on top of it by sharing our message with the world. It's a win-win for all. You get to continue to be an elite man, they get to become an elite man, and we get to continue to grow and produce these fantastic episodes for everyone. So, if you're loving the show, tell a few of your friends at work to give us a listen, a few of your buddies at the barbershop, a couple of your gym friends, and of course your very best friends everywhere to listen to the Elite Man podcast. We truly appreciate you helping us out and supporting the Elite Man message. Take care and continue to be an elite man.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.